Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 428, Sunday, June 5th, 2022.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, it is Sunday evening, and earlier today I recorded a long conversation, long-ish, with Josh Slocum of the Disaffected podcast. So, you know, the typical freemium formula is the first part of the podcast, or the first part of the conversation goes in the free podcast, and then if you want to hear the end, you got to pay. I'm doing it the opposite way this time around. Here is the first 23 minutes of my conversation with Josh Slocum, and then the rest of the conversation, which is not quite an hour more than that, is going to be on the main Sea Realm podcast, which I hope to publish in the next couple of days. So I don't really need to say a whole lot to set this up, because Josh, as you'll hear, is very, very practiced in communicating his point of view. So here we go. I am speaking with Josh Slocum of the Disaffected podcast, and I believe that I'm speaking to him in Burlington, Vermont. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
All right. So as I told you via email, I just moved to Arkansas a few months ago from Bellows Falls, Vermont, which is a very sparsely populated southeastern quadrant of the state, right on the Connecticut River.
Yep.
And moving from Vermont to Arkansas culturally is quite a change.
I mean,
it's a bigger change than it would be, say, moving from Burlington to Toronto.
You know, that would be no change at all, except for population numbers. Burlington is quite literally, and I'm not saying this to be cute or funny. I mean what I'm saying. Burlington is quite literally just a miniature Seattle or Portland.
How so?
A better question would be how not so.
Size.
It's woke. It's completely woke. It is crazed. And yeah, I mean that too. I don't mean that it's just insufferable. I mean that it's deranged. The school system here is indoctrinating children with every kind of transgender groomer ideology you can imagine. I have friends who are conservative politicians whose campaign signs are literally stolen off the street in broad daylight by their woke opponents. No consequences to them whatsoever. No punishment. They get to do whatever they want. They get to put up signs that call for the death of my friends who are against things like a bill in our legislature that would allow the state to forcibly inject puberty blockers into children over the parents' objection. Yes, literally and really, the bill would actually strip parents of the right to say no if the state decides that their child is trans. That is what I'm living in. And the majority of people here support this.
I just moved from Vermont, so I'm quite familiar with the cultural climate there.
Yeah.
When I think of Seattle and Portland and San Francisco and Los Angeles right now, I think mm-hmm. of the homeless situation mm-hmm. and the fact that the local city governments have decided that they're just not going to prosecute crimes that are committed by the homeless, mm-hmm. regardless of how severe or how regular and just habitual this pattern of behavior. It will just be tolerated infinitely. Is that going on in Burlington as well?
Yes, I have not looked at the actual statutes. I know that we have a county attorney. That is our state's attorney is what Vermont calls district attorneys. So we'll call it the district attorney. Will not prosecute there are several people here who are well known to have police records. They are well known for assault. They punch people on the street. They shoplift. They hit people over the head with pipes, We're talking serious and dangerous assault, not just slaps across the face. And our district attorney simply will not prosecute these people. When they come up in court, if they come up in court, they get suspended sentences. They are put back on the street. There's some of them who have been in court 27 times and keep getting put back out. They are not committed to a mental health facility. They will not be jailed. She simply refuses to do it. Her name is Sarah George.
So this is the behind the paywall portion. So that's not many people will hear that name. But when I was in Bellows Falls, I volunteered for a local community justice center, and I took part in COSA sessions, which are circles of support and accountability. So somebody who's just come out of prison, they would meet with a group of supporters. I was one of them, and we would, you know, ask them how they're doing and, you know, what they need for support and that sort of thing. And one of the guys I was working with, you know, he'd been a drug dealer. And he had also committed various other crimes, lots and lots of burglaries. Mm-hmm. But, and it's very easy to remain addicted to drugs in prison. And it's not just in Vermont. I mean, pretty much everywhere. It's impossible to keep drugs out of prison. He decided while in prison that he was going to get straight. And he, you know, quit on his own in prison. And, you know, when he got out on furlough, he's got a very strong work ethic, and he just, you know, he immediately took a job and started working, just threw himself into the job. And this guy is the perfect, you know, parole candidate and the perfect ex-con. He's just doing everything right. Mm-hmm. And his ex-girlfriend, who is very pretty and very charismatic, she got busted for something else. And in order to get to make a deal so she wouldn't be arrested and charged, she gave evidence against him supposedly for a bunch of burglaries that they did together.
Okay.
So the police sent this information. They made up a press release and they sent it around to the local news organizations, and they all ran with it. And they show this mugshot of this guy who is clean, hardworking, focused on getting his life together. And all the local TV stations, they're showing his mugshot, you know, with his, you know, red eyes, and, you know, looks like he hasn't slept in days. And so they're saying, this man is free. This man is in your community, you know, just scaremongering.
And let me see if I, let me make sure I understand correctly. Do I understand that the police put out a press release to besmirch this guy based on things he was not convicted for, but that his ex-girlfriend, after his conviction, claimed he did? Is that correct? Yes,
that is correct.
That's extraordinary, and it cannot be lawful. And of course, I'm sure there will be no consequences.
Some of the burglaries she implicated him in were committed while he was in prison. So it was clear that it was a lie. But they arrested him, and he had to pay thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, for attorney's fees and court fees and whatnot. And he didn't lose his job because he had a very good relationship with his employer. But, you know, he was put back in jail. So this is a guy who's doing everything right. And the criminal justice system, on the say-so of his, you know, deleted adjective ex-girlfriend, goes and destroys his life all over again, while at the same time, people who are running wild get a free pass, a perpetual free pass. I just don't understand, you know, the logic behind that, or even not even the logic, just the notion of why, you know.
Let me ask you a question. Was this gentleman ever convicted of a violent crime?
No, he was convicted of possession, dealing, and burglary.
Okay. Yeah, that's different.
Oh, I was so furious. And, you know, here I am in this situation. I'm a representative of the state. You know, I mean, I wasn't getting paid, but I still had to do a background check, and I was registered with the criminal justice system in Vermont. I was an agent of the state, and I was supposed to be supportive of the state, and I was livid. I was furious.
It's so backward. I mean, you know, I will be candid in that my sympathies today, I have very little sympathy for the convicted. So my bias may be in the other direction from yours. Mm-hmm. I am very unconcerned. I am more concerned with the number of people who should be separated for safety reasons from our society who are not. my bias is in that direction. I'm glad that there are people who are trying to help the minority of people who are fully rehabilitatable. And I hear that miscarriage of justice. But my concern right now is the number of people in society, and particularly people who belong to favored groups. I call these people having sacred caste status. And who do I mean? Women, Black people, gay people, anyone who calls themselves LGBTQ, anyone who claims they're oppressed. These people are all sacred caste now and have holy halos over their head and can do no wrong in society's eyes. And they are getting away with all sorts of crimes, all sorts of manipulation. And they are being seen as the victims when, in fact, they are the perpetrators. It's not just, I mean, prison is one, just one tiny part of the whole equation. This is going on out in society all over the place. And it's why I talk, it's why my show Disaffected has, if you will, a thesis underneath it. And that thesis is we are living in a cluster B world. Cluster B means cluster B personality disorders. For those who haven't heard of that before, pathological narcissism, emotional instability common to borderline personality disorder. That family also includes psychopathy. So they're not all the same, but they all do share similar traits. And for those who don't, who have never heard the term cluster B or who don't know what personality disorders are, and think, I don't know what that is. You do, in fact, know what it is. You just don't know it by this name, and you haven't heard it described this way before. You know it because you know, you in your mind, listener or viewer, you have an image of, in your head of some archetypal people. You have an image of the abusive husband. You have an image of the abusive mother who triangulates her children and uses them for her own gratification. You have an archetypal image of the boss who backstabs you, praises you in front of other people, but when it comes time to pay rise, throws you under the bus in front of the bigger bosses. These kinds of people that you might think of as difficult, self-centered, or you might say a phrase like, he's just a jerk. That's cluster B. That's the kind of people I'm talking about. So you are familiar with it. You just haven't heard the term yet.
Experientially, certainly. I'll ask you more about that in the you know, the big room, as I call it, sure. The main C. Rome podcast. But I noticed you just used the word triangulates in describing how a mother is talking to her children. And, you know, I mentioned I was with the I had to do a background check by the state of Vermont. And also I had to undergo some training. And one of the things that they prepared me for in dealing with convicts was the notion of triangulation, of basically, you know, speaking to different people in different ways to pit them against one another.
Yes.
It's an emotionally manipulative way of basically dividing the potential opposition.
Yes. This is, and again, this is everybody listening. You do know what triangulation is. This is probably just the first time you've heard the word. You think of it this way. When you see triangulation, you say this. He creates drama. He creates drama with people. That's triangulation. You know what it is. And it's exactly what you said. It's talking in one way to one person and in a different way to a different. And we all do that, of course. I mean, I talk in a different way to my grandmother than I talk to, you know, my best guy friends, right? I'm not talking about that. That's wholly separate. It's changing your story, misrepresenting or leaving out key facts in order to maneuver one person into seeing another person as a problem, because you want to get these people on your side. When you're the abuser, you need to recruit foot soldiers. And one of the ways to do this is to triangulate. So in the context of a family and you have an abusive parent, you will have a parent who sets the brother and sister against each other, might convince one of the siblings that the other one has a mental health problem, or the other one is just behaviorally terrible. And they do that because they want you on side with them, fighting their target with them and for them.
How long have you lived in Vermont?
Too goddamn long.
How long is that?
20 years.
Okay. A good long time. See, I moved to Vermont too late to vote for Bernie Sanders in the Vermont primary in 2016 and too early, you know, to vote in the Super Tuesday primary in New York City. So I didn't get to vote in the primary that year. But Barack Obama was on his way out. He was in his last year as president when I arrived. And Joe Biden was just at the very end of his first year as president when I left Vermont. So basically, I spent the Trump years in Vermont. And I got to watch what I call the Blue Tribe just lose their minds. Like the process.
Yeah, you saw it, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the process was already underway, but I was in New York City before I was in Vermont. So that's a different faction of the Blue Tribe there.
Yeah, they're crazy, too.
They are crazy in a different way. I wasn't living in New York City in 2011, but I did visit in 2011, and I did go to Zuccotti Park, and I witnessed the Occupy Wall Street phenomenon. And when I first got there, the public sector unions were still supportive of the occupation, and there were demonstrations which were very organized, and I was really hopeful. It seemed like, wow, there's some amazing change coming here. But then actually at Zuccotti Park, you know, they were doing the circular sort of time-wasting consensus exercises where they have the progressive stack where, you know, everybody submits their concerns, but then they're sorted so that people who have the most, you know, diversity check marks get to speak, and, you know, the straight white males or the cis white males don't.
So what you're describing is a woke matriarchy. This is female relational rules. Yep.
And then I also read David Graeber's account of it. He wrote a book about it. And, you know, he's dead now, but he was an anarchist. And the whole notion of we're not going to have any hierarchy, any officially recognized hierarchy. It's all going to be governed by these sort of, you know, behind the scenes, interpersonal power collecting that isn't recognized. Go ahead. I can see you have something to say.
Yeah. And you can boil that right down to our rules are based on the emotions of the people who are in charge. That's it. These are rules based on their feelings. When you don't have hierarchy is part of human nature. It is part of many animal natures. It is not, the word itself does not have a fundamental negative connotation. No matter how badly people emotionally react to it, it is a feature of the world. When it works right, the most competent person for the particular job in the particular group assumes a directorial or something like a leadership position and makes decisions commensurate with their level of experience and trains up people underneath them and makes teams out of them. That is when hierarchy works right. That's how it's supposed to work. When you don't have hierarchy, you have chaos.
Right.
There's not a third choice. Consensus is just a euphemism for chaos. And whoever cries hardest gets comforted most and gets her way. That's what it means.
And so when I saw how things were working down at Zuccotti Park, it didn't happen immediately, but that's when I had a shift in perspective of, wow, this is not helpful. And, you know, the sense of impending change that I felt when I first got there had, you know, that completely disintegrated. It's like, it seemed as though the anarchist, as you say, you know, matriarchal, how did you describe it? What was the phrase?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's a matriarchy. It runs on rules of emotions.
Right. But when I saw that dynamic at work, all hope that, you know, we had reached a pivot, you know, to a more humane sort of distribution in our society, that all just crumbled. It disintegrated. It's like, this is useless. And then I went to a conference in Michigan where the conference organizer was deliberately borrowing from this structure that I saw just a few weeks before at Zuccotti Park and, you know, making people sit through these long, pointless exercises. And I just started skipping.
Oh, not pointless.
Yeah,
not right. Pointless.
You're right.
Pointless for anybody who actually wants to do something. Oh, but there was a point.
So what is the point?
Well, what do you think the point was? You went to the lectures.
Yeah. Oh, they weren't even lectures, but I think in the case
of the exercises, you know.
Yeah, I think in the case of the conference that I went to, the conference organizer was just reflexively Blue Tribe, and he saw that that was the new thing, and we're just going to do that thing. But at Zuccotti Park, it just seemed like tailor made to shut down any sort of organized movement, particularly one that involved, like I say, the public sector unions, because people who actually organize into labor unions, I mean, those are very hierarchical organizations, but they're also very goal-oriented. They're very structured. They have, you know, good fundraising. They have mechanisms for supporting the people within the unions, but they also have mechanisms for enforcing some discipline. And all of that was anathema to the sort of anarchist scene at Zuccotti Park. So as soon as the public labor unions departed and said, you know, forget this stuff. We got jobs. We still have to go to work. You guys can sit around for 11 hours at a time in your circles and do whatever, but we can't do that. When they departed, it was over. And Occupy Wall Street was a nationwide phenomenon, and it just didn't know how to end. And I think that the governors who colluded to bring in the police all on the same day and break up the camps, I think they did the organizers a great favor. Because they had no plan, they had no roadmap, they had no list of demands, they had nothing, except they were just clustered.
So what the hell were they there for then? Food.
Well, it sounds as though you probably wouldn't be very sympathetic, even with a sympathetic description of their complaints about the maldistribution of opportunity and wealth in our society.
Oh, I'm not unsympathetic to that. This mm-hmm. this is ironic. Of course, we don't know each other.
Right. We're assuming.
but I'm the last person that I would have predicted that I would be taking the more conservative point of view in issues like this. Mm-hmm. I was a progressive Democrat leftist most of my life. I was supportive of Occupy Wall Street. I am not actually unsympathetic to legitimate complaints of worker mistreatment, collusion with government. I have 20 years of experience in consumer protection, and I have a lot of experience in the ways in which governmental structures that we call regulatory agencies are actually simply arms of the industry. They are rent-seeking cartels that claim to the public with the actual seal of the state, the imprimatur of the state, saying we are here to protect consumers, to make sure that service is adequate, and to adjudicate complaints. That is not why they are there, and that is not how they function. They screw consumers, and they screw the small guys in the industry by dancing to the tune of the legacy businesses that have a lot more financial clout. I am sympathetic to those claims, but I am much, much more skeptical today about the legitimacy of many of the allegations of mistreatment. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. And when it does happen, I'm on side of the person who's been victimized. I simply don't believe there are nearly as many victims as I used to believe there were.
Well said. That was a very articulate and what's the word I'm looking for? Credibility building statement you've just made there. Because you're clearly not somebody who I'm guessing we're nearly the same age. I just turned 50.
I'm 47.
Okay, so I'm a bit older than you. I'm definitely a child of the 80s. I graduated high school in 1986. My father worked for the United States Secret Service, and he was a huge George H.W. Bush fan. He wrote in George H.W. Bush for president when Reagan first ran.
Okay.
My father had been assigned to protect George Bush and just thought the world of him. And he was a devoted Rush Limbaugh ditto head. I don't know if you remember that term.
I sure do. Yeah.
Okay. And I was, the exact opposite. But the older I get and the crazier the left seems to get, the more I'm sympathetic with my father's views, although he was just, I think, constitutionally far more amenable to anybody who claims to have authority. Than I am. I'm reflexively challenging to authority. I
me too. me too.
I'm a malcontent, and he was certainly not a malcontent. He respected authority. He was in the military before he was in the Secret Service, and then he spent a career in law enforcement. And he talked genuinely and with no irony of good guys and bad guys. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement were the good guys. Criminals were the bad guys. Any more nuance than that is totally unnecessary, and it's just confusing the matter.
Okay. Understood.
All righty. So we are 23 minutes into this, almost 24 minutes into this. So I'm going to reintroduce you, and then we'll be in the big room of the Sea Realm podcast.
Okay.
You are listening to the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm speaking with fellow podcaster Joshua Slocum of the Disaffected podcast. Josh, it's good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so in the conversation with Josh, which we'll continue on the next episode of the main Sea Realm podcast, in the portion that you just heard, though, he mentioned that there is a bill in the Vermont legislature, which would allow for teenagers, basically, or I guess even preteens in some cases, to get puberty blockers if they identify as trans, but their parents do not agree. And rather than just take Josh's word for it, I decided to look it up and see if such a bill actually exists. And, well, it does. And rather than summarize it for you and leave you with the question of whether or not my summary was fair or accurate or maybe in some way misleading, it's fairly short. The text of the bill is short enough that I can just read it to you. So I'm going to do that right now. This is H-659, and it reads as follows. Introduced by Representatives Vahovsky of Essex, Small of Winooski, Burroughs of West Windsor, Cena of Burlington, Colburn of Burlington, Cordes of Lincoln, Donnelly of Hyde Park, Mulvaney Stanek of Burlington, Rachelson of Burlington, and Supremnant of Bernard. Referred to committee on this date, and the date line is blank, although at the top of the page it says 2022. Subject, health, minors, consent, gender-affirming care. Statement of purpose of bill as introduced. This bill proposes to allow a minor who identifies as transgender to consent to receiving hormone blockers and other non-surgical gender-affirming care and treatment without requiring parental consent. An act relating to allowing minors to consent to non-surgical gender-affirming care, it is hereby enacted by the General Assembly of the State of Vermont. Section 1, Findings. The General Assembly finds that, 1, according to a 2021 national survey by the Trevor Project, 42% of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning LGBTQ youth recently seriously considered attempting suicide, including more than half of transgender and non-binary youth. 2. The Trevor Project has found that affirming transgender and non-binary youth by respecting their pronouns and allowing them to change legal documents to conform to their gender identity is associated with lower rates of attempted suicide among these populations. 3. In the 2019 Vermont Youth Risk Behavior Survey, 14% of Vermont high school students reported identifying as LGBTQ in 2019, including 2% of students who identified as transgender and another 1% who reported being unsure about whether they were transgender. 4. Per the 2019 Vermont Youth Risk Behavior Survey, LGBTQ high school students were significantly more likely than their heterosexual and cisgender peers to report being subject to instances of actual or threatened physical violence, bullying, and sexual and dating violence. They were also more likely to have recently or frequently used tobacco, alcohol, or cannabis, and to have driven while under the influence of alcohol or cannabis within the past 30 days, or to have ridden in a motor vehicle with an impaired driver. 5. According to the 2019 Vermont Youth Risk Behavior Survey, 63% of LGBTQ high school students reported feeling sad or hopeless within the past year, compared with 25% of heterosexual and cisgender students. 36% of LGBTQ students said they had made a plan for how they would attempt suicide, compared with 9% of their heterosexual and cisgender peers, and 19% of LGBTQ students reported that they had attempted suicide during the past year, compared with 4% of their heterosexual and cisgender peers. 6. Numerous studies have shown that transgender youth, especially those whose families reject their transgender identity or refuse to consent to providing them gender-affirming care and treatment, are at elevated risk for anxiety, depression, and suicidality. 7. The results of a 2020 study indicated that transgender youth who took hormone blockers to delay puberty had a reduced likelihood of suicidal ideation and severe psychological distress as adults than those who wanted to take blockers but did not receive them. Section 218 VSA Chapter 233 is added to read. Chapter 233, Access to Healthcare Services. Subsection 9801, Minors' Access to Non-Surgical Gender-Affirming Care. A minor who identifies as transgender may give consent to receive hormone blockers and any other legally authorized non-surgical gender-affirming care or treatment from a licensed healthcare professional working within the healthcare professional's authorized scope of practice. Consent, under this section, shall not be subject to disaffirmance due to minority of the individual providing consent. The consent of the individual's parent or guardian shall not be necessary to authorize the minor's access to legally authorized non-surgical gender-affirming care or treatment. Section 3, effective date. This shall take effect on passage. So that's it. That's the entire text of the bill. Does it say what Josh says it says? I won't answer that for you. I don't want to sound prejudicial. So decide for yourself. All right. So sometimes I think it's okay to have a vault podcast that is less than an hour, and I'm tempted to just stop talking right now, although you know me, sometimes that's hard for me to do. In the next part of the conversation that you're going to hear, I mean, you won't hear it on this podcast. It'll be on the main CROM podcast, but we do talk about the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial. And it's weird because when I look at mainstream media, like I was just looking at a piece in Rolling Stone, I'll just read a bit from it to you. And rather than, you know, characterizing it in advance, I'll just let you decide. What is the viewpoint of Rolling Stone here? Headline, Men Always Win. Survivors Sickened by the Amber Heard Verdict. Subheadline, It didn't matter what the verdict was. As one domestic violence survivor puts it, quote, this case is my worst fear playing out on a public stage, close quote. So the author of this article is E.J. Dixon, and it continues. Over the past few weeks, Megan has been watching the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial with a sinking feeling. A few years ago, she had been involved in a contentious breakup with her then-husband following years of physical and emotional abuse, which led to her calling the police repeatedly. Like Heard, Megan, whose last name Rolling Stone has chosen to withhold, had recorded his outbursts and threats of violence and self-harm in case, she says, quote, if he killed me, there would be evidence, close quote. Like Heard, when she spoke out about her ex, she received a letter from his lawyer accusing her of defamation, and like Heard, she says her husband's lawyer tried to argue that she had borderline personality disorder, a form of mental illness, as a means of trying to discredit her. Megan initially tried to avoid the Depp-Heard trial as much as she could, as it caused her to experience PTSD flashbacks. But throughout the trial, everything from Heard's hair and clothing to her tearful testimony became fodder for countless memes, while Depp's cocksure behavior on the stand inspired innumerable fawning TikTok videos, cryptocurrency, and Etsy merch. The discourse was unavoidable. Quote, it's been bizarre to see friends I thought were supportive posting disgusting Amber Heard memes, close quote. When she heard that Depp had heard, and this is capital H-E-A-R-D as in Amber Heard, when she heard that Depp had heard with total global humiliation after she came forward with abuse allegations against him, it was too much for Megan to handle. Her ex had long threatened her with the same thing. Quote, this case is my worst fear playing out on a public stage. It tells me that my ex was right. If he chose to, he could destroy and humiliate me beyond repair, close quote. This feeling was only exacerbated on Wednesday after a jury in Fairfax, Virginia found Amber Heard guilty of defaming Depp in a 2018 op-ed for the Washington Post, in which she identified as a public face of domestic abuse survivors without explicitly naming Depp. Despite presenting photos of her injuries, video recordings of Depp's meltdowns, and witness testimony supporting her claims of abuse, Depp was awarded $10 million plus $5 million in punitive damages. Heard was also awarded $2 million for winning one point in her countersuit. But in truth, the highly publicized trial was decided in the court of public opinion weeks ago. As it played out over the last few weeks, with people on social media overwhelmingly aligning with the beloved Pirates of the Caribbean star, millions of stans and even brands and celebrities have excoriated Heard and accused her of fabricating the allegations against Depp, causing hashtags like Amber Turd and Justice for Johnny Depp to trend worldwide. Quote, this is basically the end of Me Too, close quote, says Dr. Jessica Taylor, a psychologist, forensic psychology PhD, and author of two books on misogyny and abuse. She tells Rolling Stone, quote, it's the death of the whole movement, close quote. So, they mention that she is the author of two books. I'm looking at her most recent book right now, which is a bestseller. It is called Psycho But Sexy, How the Patriarchy Uses Women's Trauma Against Them. As the verdict came in, sexual assault survivors expressed their disappointment with the decision, even if they were not surprised by it. "I don't think it's unexpected, but it's horrible," says one survivor, who herself faced a defamation claim after coming forward against her own abuser and requested her name be withheld for legal reasons. She says the claim was dropped, but that watching her be dragged through the mud during the trial brought back memories of her own experience, which she says was traumatic and led her to consider suicide. "I feel really glad to think my case didn't go ahead and stupid to think I could have won it," she says. Men always win. So that's not the end of the article, but that's the end of my reading from it. The point here was to give you a sense of the tone and the framing. So I take the framing here to be Amber Heard, you know, she is the victim of male violence, and she was absolutely justified in calling out Johnny Depp, you know, even if she didn't name names. It was clear who she was talking about, and his career certainly did suffer as a result. According to Dr. Jessica Taylor, according to Rolling Stone, she was absolutely justified and, you know, in no way in the wrong in this instance. And the patriarchy shut her down like it shuts down all women who make justified and righteous claims of having suffered abuse. And an evil, victimizing man has been given a free pass by a society which worships victimizing men. I haven't talked to a lot of people about this trial, but I haven't actually exchanged words, either spoken or typed words, with any human being who accepts this framing, you know, who takes this point of view. Pretty much everybody that I've had any discussion with on this topic says that, and I have to admit, I did not watch the trial, but I did see excerpts from it, and I have heard a lot of people talking about it. So, yeah, I'm not an expert on this trial. I can't even say that I sat through the whole thing. In fact, I didn't watch any portion of it live. So you could easily say that the bits that I have watched were curated for me to lead me to a particular conclusion. And, you know, fair enough. But pretty much everybody that I've talked to, you know, the position has been neither one of them were saints. There were no good guys at work here. These are both very damaged people. But she did unfairly defame Johnny Depp with, you know, in this opinion piece that she didn't actually write. It was ghostwritten for her by lawyers and writers at the ACLU, you know, the American Civil Liberties Union, to whom she had pledged to give $3 million if they were to name her as an artist ambassador for gender justice. I'm actually on the ACLU.org page right now. So I'm reading from News and Commentary, What You Need to Know About ACLU Artist Ambassadors, Including Amber Heard. And this is the third paragraph down. In 2016, Ms. Heard pledged to donate $3.5 million over 10 years to the ACLU. 2 years later, in 2018, the ACLU invited Ms. Heard to become an ambassador and to work with us on an op-ed to bring attention to the issue of sexual assault and domestic violence issues. She agreed. Through her ambassadorship, Ms. Heard supported our advocacy for gender justice issues, a cause that has long been central to our mission, at least since Ruth Bader Ginsburg headed the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. So that's, you know, that's not a prejudicial framing against the ACLU and Amber Heard. This is the ACLU framing it for you. But they admit she had pledged to give them $3.5 million, and they named her an artist ambassador for gender justice. And then they ghostwrote a piece for her that was published in the Washington Post, which was severely damaging to Johnny Depp's career, and which this jury in Virginia has affirmed, yes, that was defamation of Johnny Depp. Now, the issues around the monetary awards, he gets $15 million, she gets $2 million. The maximum award that can be given in Virginia in a case like this is $350,000, I think. $325,000. It's considerably less than $1 million. So really, in terms of money changing hands and one person getting rich at the other person's expense, there is no monetary consequences for either party in this trial. Both the amount that he's been ordered to pay her and the amount that she's been ordered to pay him will be equal. So it is essentially a wash. The only people getting paid are the lawyers. So, you know, the Rolling Stone article says that this trial was, you know, the verdict was reached in the court of public opinion weeks before the official verdict. Yeah, that's true. And really, the only lasting significant verdict is the one that is rendered by the court of public opinion. So I hope you notice I'm being careful here. I'm trying not to put words in anybody's mouth, and I'm not trying to present to you, you know, my skewed vision of what happened as the truth. I'm admitting that I'm coming to this late, and, you know, I'm telling you exactly where I'm getting the information that I'm sharing with you. All that said, like most people I know, I was certainly rooting for Johnny Depp in this case, you know, in this contest. Does that mean that Amber Heard and Dr. Jessica Taylor are right, that our civilization and our society is brutally patriarchal, and any woman who dares complain of the persistent abuse that she must endure will be slandered in the court of public opinion? I'm not saying it's totally false. Slut shaming is a thing. But in this instance, you know, that framing really just doesn't seem to fit the facts. And Amber Heard does strike me as manipulative and dishonest. I don't like to, you know, diagnose people with mental illness, particularly people I've never met and will never meet. So I have no opinion whether or not she has borderline personality disorder. But borderline personality disorder is a big part of the conclusion of the conversation with Joshua Slocum that you'll hear in the next episode of the C-Rome, the main C-Rome podcast, the Big Room Conversation. All right, I am going to leave it there. No ranting, no broad brush opinions. I can't really claim that I don't have a dog in this fight. Johnny is my dog. And I'm not too worried about, you know, the state of his career. One more Pirates of the Caribbean movie, and he will make more, you know, in a few months' time than I will make in my entire lifetime. I'm not worried about Johnny Depp. All right, I'm going to leave it there. Tell me what you think. You know how to reach me. I'll talk to you again quite soon. Stay well.